The unruffled beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees signals Wednesday, 8 p.m., and time for So What's Your Story? We're the only program originating in Houston devoted to live storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. And for those who prefer the visual medium, we're on Facebook as well. Each week we revel in the power of story by placing the spotlight on remarkable tellers, tellers who engage us with stirring personal stories as well as treasured traditional folk tales, tellers who show us how stories connect us to our past, give meaning to our present, and give direction to our future, and tellers who take us on captivating journeys and then return us safely home. I'm Warren Holloman. Tonight I'll be your host. And joining me as tonight's featured storyteller is an artist whose stories have been told in theaters all over the world. Ted Swindley is best known for creating the hit musical Always Patsy Cline, which opened in New York in June 1997, and it's been a major hit. If you've seen it, you know why. Here in Houston, Ted is known for something he did many years earlier, 1978, A Basement in Houston. He became the founding artistic director of Stages Repertory Theater. They started in a basement, but now they're the second largest theater in Houston. And as he'll tell us in a minute, they're about to expand again. In his career so far, Ted has directed and or produced over 200 plays, and of course he's written quite a few as well. He's written musicals such as Honky Tonk Angels, The Honky Tonk Angels Holiday Spectacular, Step Into My Parlor, an Everly Brothers musical called Bye Bye Love, The Summer of 66, Swing Step, which was nominated for the Dora Award, which is the Canadian equivalent of the Tony, and a musical called Bachelor Pad, which was based on a short story by William Safire and featured classics from the 50s and 60s. He's also written lots of plays. Stories My Grandmother Told Me began as a series of short stories, and he later developed it into a full-length play to tell one larger story. And he'll be telling some of those stories a little later on tonight. He's also recently written Rebel Yell, which is about racism in the South in 1920. And one other thing that piqued my interest from his bio is that he's written a series of children's Christmas stories, and I'm hoping we can get him back maybe in December to tell some of those. Well, Ted, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Thank you, Warren. It's wonderful to be here.
We're absolutely delighted. And I just got to start out with the big one, Always Patsy Cline. Congratulations.
Thank you. Well, you know what's so interesting about that is it started here in Houston 30 years ago.
Yeah.
In 1988 at Stages.
Yeah.
We did the very first production, and it's been all over. Right now we're doing the second tour in Australia. So it's just been an amazing. And to this subject we're on about storytelling, it truly is a storytelling piece. It is a woman at her kitchen table basically relaying the events of meeting Patsy Cline.
And she does it through her letters and her songs.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's incredible.
Yeah.
I saw it many years ago. I need to go back again. I love it.
Well, you
it.
Know, it's a Houston story. It's set in Houston. And that's the I always say the question that changed my life is I asked the question, did Patsy Cline ever play in Houston?
Yeah.
And I found out that happened. So,
yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, she's a compelling figure.
Yes, absolutely.
In terms of her life as well as her music.
Yes.
Talk about Stages. What's going on there now?
Oh, gosh. I'm so proud of the theater. It's just, we're in our 40th anniversary this year. It's just mind-boggling to me. But the team that is there now, Ken McLaughlin, the artistic director, and Mark Folks, the managing director, and a very dynamic board of directors, we're about to break ground this summer on a brand new theater. It will be a 3-theater complex, and it's going to be amazing, state of the art.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yes, thank you. Well, it's a far cry from when we were in the basement on Franklin Street, and we had raccoons. One night, a raccoon actually came on stage in the middle of a show and sat sat in the middle of the center stage and then waddled off. The actors froze. He went, and the play went on. So, and the other thing that was interesting there too, we were underneath a Chinese restaurant that had a leaky dishwasher, and it leaked on the heads of our patrons, so we'd have to put up a tarp. So it's all very glamorous, and now to see where it is today is just amazing.
Well, we were just chatting a while ago, and it's just interesting to me that Houston's two biggest theaters, one started in an alley,
yeah,
and the other in a basement.
Yeah, it's true.
That's progress.
Yeah, it is, really.
And you've got a show, Ann Richards show, coming up. Talk about that.
Yes, this is going to be a wonderful event. It's a play developed by Holland Taylor, and it's a one-woman show about Ann Richards. It's set in her office in Austin, and the remarkable actress Sally Edmondson, who actually started with me and acted in The Basement all those many years ago, is playing Ann Richards. It's going to be a spectacular, spectacular show.
Incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were artistic director for many years. What does an artistic director do?
Well, primarily we're in charge of choosing the repertory, choosing the season, what we will do, and then staffing and casting, and then, of course, I would always direct, as Ken does, several shows in a season. So, yeah, that's primarily what you do.
And for those who follow your career, of course, you were here in Houston back in the 70s and 80s.
Yes.
And then you moved to New York?
No, I actually moved. My biggest move was to Nashville, uh-huh, of all places. I never expected that, but because the Grand Ole Opry got wind of my Patsy Cline show,
yeah,
and we reopened the old Ryman Auditorium, uh-huh, on the stage where Patsy actually performed.
Right.
And it facilitated me moving there and spending there many years there. And then I was in New York for a while as well.
Well, tonight we'll come back and circle back to those,
yeah,
but I want to be sure we get right into a story. And you're going to tell us some of the, I think, three of the stories that your grandmother told you.
Yeah, they are. These three that I've chosen tonight are pretty light. And actually, these are not necessarily stories that she told me, but these are stories that we basically lived together.
Yeah.
So
I'll just read as an mm-hmm intro. Mm-hmm. I found the review of the world premiere, which was in the American Heartland Theater in Kansas City, by Brian McTavish. Stories my grandmother told me isn't just for people whose loving grandmothers told them stories growing up. No, stories my grandmother told me is as much or more for people whose grandmothers did not like to talk much. For those folks, this tender-hearted undertaking can act as a window on another world, or maybe even lead to a healing experience. Magic is just waiting to happen.
I'd like to say that right now I feel like I'm auditioning for a play. And I've never been on that side very much anyway. So, and I have changed the names to protect the innocent. So you should know that.
You're from a Southern family.
I am, absolutely.
We know about that.
Oh, yes, we do. And, yeah. And there's one little section. I will do a slight bit of singing. So, I'm not, anyway, you get the idea. You'll bear it. It's not very long. So. Okay. These stories are based on fact filtered through the fiction of the heart. It was the loveliest of southern afternoons. I was 16 years old with a new driver's license in my alligator wallet. I drove my parents' large green Chrysler New Yorker to grandmother's house. It was my first solo journey, and my new independence required that I honor grandmother with this inaugural rite of passage. I pulled up the steep driveway of her English Tudor-style home and parked next to her gold Cadillac, which had survived many injuries from her curious driving habits. I remember her expression to passengers when she rather abruptly ran into the side of a bridge once, practically tearing off the right side front of the car, saying only, "Excuse me, I'm sorry," and she continued on her way. I hope that I had inherited her courage in driving and in living. I was very anxious to see her, to talk to her about the new freedom that a driver's license brings, but I doubted that we would ever touch the subject. There were always too many other strange and wonderful topics to discuss. I entered the house through the usually unlocked side door, but I noticed that it was unusually quiet. I stood for a moment in the Wonder Room. Grandmother had names for all of her rooms, Victorian names like parlor for the living room, drawing room for the den, and of course we never said porch, only veranda. Poetic terms used by a neo-Victorian Southern woman. But why was this particular room called the Wonder Room? To this question, she would always reply gleefully, "Because I wonder where anything is." The room was really a breakfast room, which she had converted into an office of sorts, not the office of a working person, but a cluttered, disorganized sanctuary for a volunteer with many causes. Beautify America, keep prayer in the schools. Oh, and of course, her favorite, very favorite, Stop ERA. These were projects that she did to save the world, or to save her world, from the liberalism of the latter half of the post-Victorian century. "Why do we need a silly old equal rights amendment for women anyway?" she said. "Real ladies know how to maintain power over a man, and we have for a good long time without publicly burning a certain item of our undergarments, honestly." So I stood in the silent wonder of the room and noticed in the distance the birdcage that held her pet canary called Gems. She named the pet after herself using her initials G-E-M-S. Gladys Elizabeth McPherson Sterling, the same initials that adorned her specialty license plate on her bruised Cadillac. But I noticed that Jim's, the pet canary, was not singing today. "Grandma," I called, no answer. "Grandma, are you home?" I began to worry. "Grandmother, are you all right?" She came in. "Of course I'm all right." She answered. She came briskly in from the veranda. "I told you that I will only answer to grandmother. I am not a ma or a mama. I am your grandmother." And having made her point, she came to me and presented her cheek for a dutiful kiss from her eldest grandson. She bustled into the Wonder Room looking for something she had lost. "An invitation to the governor's mansion. There's a reception today for the Rose Society, and I've forgotten what time it starts." Well, I asked her, "Grandmother, what is wrong with Jim's? Why is she not singing? Is she ill?" Grandmother replied, "Oh, that's not Jim's. Jim's died this morning." I walked to the cage and inquired about the new creature inhabiting the ornate iron bird palace. "Did you buy a new bird?" Her eyes filled with tears. "Oh, no, no one could replace Jim's. But I couldn't bear having an empty cage, so I went to the 5 and dime store," and it was at that moment that I realized that I noticed that she had bought an imitation canary and wrapped its wire feet to the cage's perch as a memorial, or perhaps a denial of having lost her feathered friend, by replacing it with a facsimile which allowed grandmother to believe that Jim's was still alive. Then I said, "Shall I drive you to the reception?" I wanted to change the subject to my happier news. "Drive me? You?" she said in astonishment. Her reply was filled with surprise, but also with a sense of time passing. I was now a young man, and she an auburn-haired lady of 61. "That would be wonderful," she said, and she disappeared to fetch her hat and gloves out of the Wonder Room, through the drawing room, the parlor, and into her powder-blue boudoir. As I begin to write down these memories of stories which grandmother told me, I thought of the death of Jim's and of the stuffed replacement in the cage. I feel perhaps these reflections are much like grandmother's feeble attempt to create a memorial for her bird by replacing her with a facsimile which allows me to believe that she is still here. My ornate cage is this book, and my stuffed bird are these stories, the spirit of which has inspired them, has flown somewhere beyond, but the memorable strains of grandmother's brilliant songs remain, with a few feathers left behind.
Oh, my. I'd like to sit with your story for just a moment, if we could.
Sure.
So say a little bit more about that metaphor at the ending, how the canary and your grandmother are reflections of each other.
Well, I know that they're reflections of each other. I think what it was that episode when I started writing these stories, I thought, in a way, I really believe that she was either creating a memorial to her. She loved that bird. I mean, really loved that bird. And then, and she created this kind of memorial. She didn't, I don't think she even thought to take the cage out of the room. I don't think that crossed her mind. I think it was just, I've got to replace. And so she did this little memorial. And so, in a way, the stories and the play and the book are memorials to her.
Right. I mean, so the quote normal thing to do would have either been to take the cage away.
She didn't do things quite normally. she was very, she was not a typical grandmother in any way. I've often referred to her as a kind of a right wing Auntie Mame. She was the kind of grandmother, that she, number one, she could not cook. We all think grandmothers should cook.
Right.
No, if we went to grandmother's house and she would ask us to stay for dinner, we'd all make polite excuses to be sure we didn't have to eat there.
So she's a Southern Victorian lady,
yes,
who could not cook very well.
Yes, yes. And she was a great volunteer and an organizer, and she very politically motivated and into... one of the things she was big into was the temperance movement, which brought us the Prohibition, amendment way back when.
Yeah.
But there was an organization, there is an organization called the Women's Christian Temperance Union.
Yeah.
Now, when I was born, the day that I was born, she was on the speaker's rostrum giving a speech about temperance. And a woman ran up to her with a telegram announcing that I had just been born. And at that moment, she made that convention vote by acclamation that I was a lifetime member of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. So here I am today.
Have you been a loyal member?
Well, we'll see.
Well, for you young people, temperance is really a misnomer. They're an abstinence union.
Abstinence. Total abstinence.
But they call themselves temperance. And for you young people also, the ERA was a really big deal back in 1972, 1973.
Right.
But unfortunately, we don't talk about it anymore today. The Equal Rights Amendment for women.
For women,
which was never ratified by the states, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're just tuning in, this is So What's Your Story here on 90.1 FM. KPFT Houston. You can catch us on 89.5 in Galveston, 91.9 in Huntsville, and online at www.kpft.org. I'm Warren Holloman. I'm here with Ted Swindley, who's telling tales from his short story collection and his play, Stories My Grandmother Told Me. He's just told us a Southern Gothic story about a dead canary.
Yes, yes.
And now I think I'm ready, and I think we're all ready for another one.
I have another story that's also about something artificial. I'll let you know.
Okay, all right.
So, when Gladys and my grandfather moved from our ancestral home, which she named Hope Hill, the dairy farm it had been was no longer, due largely to the fact that independent dairies were run out of business because of health reasons. Milk had to be distributed in paper cartons instead of those wonderful crystal clear cold glass bottles. The cost of new technology prohibited independent dairy farmers to continue. As the main street shops, neighborhood grocery stores, and the family-owned farms disappeared from our landscape, our country has never been quite the same. And for me, a glass of milk has never tasted the same since then. But I am reminded that one of our lessons in this existence is that life is change. From cradle to grave, from Main Street to interstate, even Hope Hill changed. After the decision was made to close the farm, my father and grandfather decided to turn it into suburban housing. The hard work of the farm was replaced with the equally demanding management of constructing cookie-cutter dwellings. From Main Street to interstate, life has changed. Grandmother was delighted. Finally, I get to move into the city. And indeed, they found the perfect home. The Tudor home, the Tudor-style one that had the parlor, veranda, and the room that would shortly become the Wonder Room. Her love for roses caused her to name it Rose Manor, even though it did not have a rose bush on the place. Well, after all, I am a relative of the founder of the American Rose Society, she said. But what about the roses for Rose Manor? I asked. William? She said in her sweetest tone. You see, my grandfather did have a first name, William. Called by most people as Big Bill, which he was, or later during the Star Wars phenomenon, the youngest grandchildren called him Jabba Bill. But when she called for William, he winced, because he knew he was in for another request for something new. William, we have to do something about this place. Do you realize there are no roses here at Rose Manor? So what? He grunted. He always grunted when he spoke to Gladys. This is important, darling. Darling. That endearment was the kiss of death. Never really used it as an affectionate form of address, but more as a sheer act of manipulation. Listen, darling, this is Rose Manor. We have no roses. I will save a lot of money by not having to buy roses for my hospital flower arrangements, and the grandchildren will love it. There it was, the ultimate manipulative ploy. She was always able to work in the grandchildren, for she knew it was his soft spot. Jabba grunted again. It was a victory. The grunt meant a tacit yes. He had learned no longer to argue with her. Oh, and dear, I think our veranda is too small. I have a great plan to expand it a little so we can have parties in the summer, in the hot summers, for the grandchildren. Another grunt. Another victory. She usually timed these requests during the Sunday afternoon football games on TV. Now, as you probably know, in the South, football for the men is a more serious form of religion than church could ever be. It was a good tactic. Now let me watch the game, he bellowed, as she happily danced onto her small veranda, thinking of her plans for its expansion and the new rose garden that it would overlook. Within 2 weeks, workers from our construction company were at work. Grandmother, what are you doing all this for? For roses at Rose Manor, of course, she said. Well, I replied, really? But Rose Manor has been around a long time without any roses. Exactly. Now, John Mark, you mustn't breathe a word of this. Well, as I always say, a secret's no fun unless you tell somebody. Gladys delivered the good news. I received a call from the State Garden Club convention, and they want to have a big reception here at Rose Manor next summer, when the roses will be in full bloom. We will have the party on our veranda. It will be gorgeous. So that's why you want the new rose garden. But Daddy and Granddaddy will figure it out. Gladys said, in a few months, the construction will be done. Dozens of rose bushes will be planted, and it won't matter. I'm not telling a story or a lie. I will just explain to them how amazing it was that God's blessing was on this little project of mine all along. And it is. Well, the month passed, the convention neared, and Grandmother made a very uncomfortable discovery. I don't have a green thumb. Well, in fact, she had not been tending her garden too well, and the roses were not blooming. As the temperature rose outside, the panic began to set in. What am I going to do? The State Garden Club is coming to this house, and I don't have one rose to show for it, and it's next week. Then a gleam came to her eye. I grunted, because I knew I was in for some work. Now, she said, what we will do is this. I knew it. We will go to all the dime stores in town and buy all the artificial roses they have. Hundreds of them. What? Plastic flowers? A memory of Jim's, her pet canary, which she replaced with a fake one, comes to mind. So we did buy every single plastic rose within miles, and we went into the garden, and attached dozens of these flowers to the prickly bushes. Ouch! We made sure that we had divided these plastic atrocities into different colors so that bushes would appear uniform and not like some kind of hybrid science fiction experiment, which would have been a lot more fun. Well, the big day came. It was a hot, sunny, sultry afternoon. She had prettied up the house. Her house was never immaculately clean, but she knew how to pretty up, as she said. Just before the convention gather, I asked her, won't they figure it out? She said, what, darling? I mean, when the ladies walk into the garden, won't they realize that the roses are plastic? Plus, they'll sweat their makeup off when they're out there. Gladys replied, oh, my precious darling, all southern women are allergic to the heat and the sun. They'll never go out to the garden. It's just too darn hot. And please remember, horses sweat, men perspire, and ladies glow. So the ladies of the club descended onto Rose Manor, all puffed and powdered, smelling of Estee Lauder, wearing pastel dresses, hats, and some with traditional white gloves, they gathered on the greatly enlarged and breezy veranda to the oohs and ahs of compliments for Gladys. One woman came up to Gladys and said, oh, Gladys, your home is just lovely. I said, come over here, ladies, and look at the garden. Another woman says, Gladys, your roses are absolutely gorgeous. Thank you, she answered in her humble and genteel manner, as if to say, it was nothing. We removed the plastic roses from the thorny bushes the very next day. Ouch.
Ouch.
Yeah.
So you've got the stuffed bird.
And the artificial plastic flowers.
I just have to ask, did she have those pink flamingos in the yard?
No. She was very classy in her taste. She had lots of antiques and all, but she would come up with all these kind of crazy things.
She had a sense of humor, though.
Oh, very much. Oh, very much. She was playful and wonderful.
You mentioned in the first story about how she said a good... ladies don't need an ERA to get equal rights amendment to get what they want. And then this story, I like the way it built on that because you gave examples of how she manipulated with her language.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
William.
William.
And
the
way she said darling.
Darling. Oh, yeah.
That was
the kiss of death whenever she called him that. You know, something was coming. So, but he learned not to argue with her.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And I even like the way she would use the expression, we want to have God's blessing on this project.
But, well, what I'm not getting into a whole lot tonight is, of course, her religiosity.
Yeah.
She was a very staunch Christian, Southern Baptist, evangelical.
Yes.
And in one part of the play and in the stories, I tell about how I went to a camp meeting in Florida to a revival, and I was saved. Mm-hmm. And I ask myself now, what was I saved from? I was only 10 years old.
Right. I was saved a few times also.
Yes, yes.
I was raised a Southern Baptist as well. I believe you were raised in South Carolina?
Yes, South Carolina.
And
yes.
I was just across the state line in North Carolina.
That's right. That's right. That's
and
right.
We probably both spent summers at Ridgecrest.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course. Yeah. Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Of summer course. Camp where you would get saved at least every other year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I was 10, and it was, of course, quite an event when I got baptized. So.
Yes. Yes. Well, Ted, I'm going to give you a chance to catch your breath while I check in with Nicole Rocherlin, our engineer tonight, and, of course, our media maven, and Tatiana Gago, our production intern. Ladies, I'm going to start you off. I just want to ask about your grandmothers. Did you have a grandmother that Ted's grandmother reminded you of, or did your grandmother tell you stories?
My granny, I like to call her. She was amazing.
She did not insist that you call her grandmother?
No, it was granny all the way. And granny to me means she was my grandmother plus my friend.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
So that's what that means. But she told us some stories, but she mostly created stories, like the time, you know, she was in church and she sung falsetto soprano and everyone in the church turned around and took the attention away from the choir. I mean, she did things like that. It was never a dull moment, as we would say.
So she had an Auntie Mame kind of theatrical.
She wasn't very religious as well, but she was an amazing woman.
How about you? Go ahead,
I just wanted to say I love you relating that. I have found that so often when I've seen the play and the audiences all want to tell their stories, so it elicits stories from everyone who sees it, and it's kind of wonderful.
Thank you so much.
It starts a cascade of storytelling.
It does. It really does. It really
I like
does.
That a lot.
Yeah.
How about you, Tatiana?
Oh, for my grandmother. Well, I call her Tata. That's her name for me. And she would always tell me these stories that she had in Colombia when she lived in her own home. She would have this mango tree. And always with this tree, they would, like, the mangoes, when they were ready, they would fall on someone's head. And she had all of these dogs, and then whenever she would always tell me the story where she had this older, like this Doberman, and one day he was sleeping, and this mango just fell on his head, and he just started barking and going around the house in panic.
He had a Sir Isaac Newton moment, it sounds like. Yeah. Well, whether your grandmother was a storyteller or not, you'll love the stories you hear at The Moth. Right, Nicole?
That is right, Warren. Actually, the February Moth Story Slam will be Tuesday, February 13th at Warehouse Live. And the theme, appropriately for Valentine's Day, of course, is Love Hurts. You can come and listen. I think I'm going to this one. Or you can put your name in the hat and tell a story. Tell about the misery of good love gone bad, or about your heart kicked to the curb by the people you love. You know, fun stuff like that.
The Valentine's Day show is always popular. So as one who's been there many times before, I just want to remind our listeners to come early if you want to get a ticket and get a seat. But it's worth it. 500 Houstonians crammed into Warehouse Live sharing their love stories. And what I like about it in particular is that the audience is so intergenerational. There will be a lot of millennials, like Nicole and Tatiana, but there will also be a lot of baby boomer geezers like me, and all in this love thing together. It's really nice. Tatiana?
And speaking of the Valentine's theme, be sure to tune into our show next week when Hank will be hosting. He's kicking off the season of love in style with Valentine stories by storytellers Paul Tepekian, Ray DePew, and Jackie Ford. And our romantic theme will continue on our February 14th show as well, with Mary hosting and featuring a cluster of love letters, only on Pacifica Radio KPFT 90.1 Houston.
And while we're talking about our show, a reminder that you can stream us live on KPFT.org and also on Facebook Live. If you visit our Facebook page, be sure to share our page with your friends, and we'd love it if you'd like us before you leave. And if that's not enough, check out our program clips on YouTube. If you'd like to go back into the archives and hear our past shows, you can do that too. Just log in to the Houston Storytellers Guild website at www.HoustonStorytellers.org. Click on the radio program link and you'll see all our shows from the past 10 years.
And speaking of the Houston Storytellers Guild, first, a big thank you, as always, for our sponsor and for all of you do to promote the art and craft of storytelling. And a reminder to our listeners that the Guild meets the fourth Tuesday of every month at Temple Emmanuel at 1500 Sunset for a story swap. You can come and enjoy the stories, or you can tell a story of your own. And if you wish, they'll give you feedback. Things they liked, and things that they might make the story better. It's a small, friendly group, so the feedback is easy to take, and always helpful.
Thank you, Nicole. Thank you, Tatiana. And I trust your semester is getting off to a good start, by the way. I forgot to ask about that.
Oh, my God.
Uh-oh. That's another story, huh?
That is another story. But this is my last semester. Yay! So I'm super-duper excited and grateful for this last little journey. Yes. I'm excited, though.
Well, we're very proud of you. We've seen you through over half of that journey.
Yes.
You've done a great job.
Thank you. Three honors in. Salute. Kudos to myself.
Yes. And you deserve it. Tatiana, you're in the third year as well. Your third year, right?
Yes, it's my third year of college, and I have one more year left.
Congratulations to you, too. Well, if you're just tuning in, my guest tonight is Ted Swinley, and he's telling tales from his short story collection and his play by the same name, Stories My Grandmother Told Me. Ted, I think we're all finding your grandmother to be very unique and very fascinating. We're all ears. So how about another story? I understand you've got one more story.
I do.
And this
is
kind of a bit of a culmination.
Yes, it is.
Story.
I'm going to read to you the end of the play.
Okay.
Okay. All right. I never missed a Christmas at grandmother's, even after I did the unthinkable and chose to go to school out west. To Texas, no less. You're not moving west, she said. She said it as though west was a dirty word. But escaping to the wild blue Texas skies gave me a sense of my own independence, my own inner strength. On December the 13th, a few years later, my phone rang. It was my mother. Your grandmother had a stroke. You better come home tonight. Is she? No, it's very serious. Let me know your arrival time and your father will meet you at the airport. This felt like another rite of passage, like the first ride you take with a brand new driver's license and an alligator wallet. Packing hurriedly, taking an airplane halfway across the country for a family emergency is a new shared experience for my generation, the generation that exploded the nuclear family into disoriented bits which have rained like atomic fallout over the continent. Now, in the play, I have a dialogue with a younger me when I was a young man, and I say to my younger self, and that is what we will have from her. Faith, confidence, passion. That's what grandmother always had, and so will we. Not the specifics like she had. We'll have a lot of questions to go along with our faith, our confidence, and our passions. My younger self says, sounds scary. And I said, you'll get used to it. Let's see. Grandmother died on Christmas Day at lunchtime, the day on which she always held court and held us in her spell It was by sheer force of her will, the doctors said, no one could have sustained life for 12 days after such a massive hemorrhage. But they didn't know Gladys. She was the best actress I ever knew, and she never set foot on a stage, but she knew how to make a grand exit. She didn't like much that I didn't become the governor of the state or a Baptist minister. The last conversation we had was by telephone. I had just received national recognition in a prominent magazine for men and women under the age of 40 who were making a difference in the field of arts and letters. There was a full-page photograph of me, and most certainly I felt a sense of accomplishment. I sent Gladys a copy of the magazine and waited a few days to call. Did you get the magazine? There was a long pause across the line. Are you there, Grandmother? Finally, she spoke. Yes, I'm here, and yes, I received your magazine. Another pause. I hoped for her approval. No, I craved it. She meant so much to me. I loved her with my whole heart. Awkwardly, I asked, well, what did you think about the picture and the article, I mean? She replied, you are my oldest grandson. Yes, I know. It was clear that the roots of the family tree were not growing in the direction she had hoped for. She continued, I just want you to know that I still pray every day that you will go into the ministry. I couldn't believe my response. Well, I just want you to know, Grandmother, that I am in the ministry. The difference is that in my pulpit, I don't give people the answers. I simply ask them the questions. There was another uncomfortable pause, and then as she put down the receiver, I heard her singing, if you're saved and you know it, say amen. If you're saved and you know it, say amen. If you're saved and you know it, then your life will surely show it. If you're saved and you know it, say amen. Amen. My life in the theater caused her to say, well, I never thought that one of my grandchildren would grow up to be show trash. Yes, show trash. But she said it with a smile. Her funeral was a grand affair, as you might expect. She looked beautiful, a rose, and her white-pearled New Testament in her hands. As you approached her casket, there was the distinctive heavy scent of Estee Lauder perfume. It seemed that a few hundred people were present at the celebration of her life. By now, most everyone knew her as the Rose Lady. Appropriately, the floral tributes were roses of every kind, some arranged with lush green magnolia leaves. Afterwards, I went with the family to her home. A woman walked up to me. Are you hungry, John Mark? Southerners and their funeral casseroles. No, thank you, ma'am. A lady from the Garden Club convention approached me. Your grandmother was such a lovely lady. And I said, I know. The woman continued. She loved you very much. She so enjoyed showing us that magazine article about you. We were all so impressed, and she was so proud of you. Well, you could have knocked me over with a canary feather. I slipped into the quiet of the Wonder Room and began to look for the perfect memento that I could take before the family scavengers could begin dividing up the spoils. And there it was, a simple paperweight, one of those domed objects that magnify the item underneath it. As I looked into it, I saw something in needlepoint. And believe me, Gladys was never the type to do arts and crafts. But when I noticed the poor quality of the stitching, I knew it was her handiwork. On a white background, there appeared this short protestation, Stop ERA, which prompted the memory of another story Grandmother told me, but that's for another time.
How long ago was that? Did she die?
Well, the year she's been gone for 25 years probably, something right. like that. No.
Do you still have the memento of her?
Well, I have that. I still have that paperweight. I surely do.
So that's a. I know that in play sometimes you change.
No, that's true. That's true.
But wow.
Yeah, I have it. It was the one. That just summed her up to me. Just to have that one little piece of her, which is kind of really wonderful.
To me, that's a powerful story. It's bitter and sweet. But it turns out to be mostly sweet.
Yes.
But there's such a yearning for approval that I think most Southerners can identify with their parents or grandparents, and it's not always given out that easily. I think we parents are much more quick to give out our approval for anything,
right.
other than a felony. Either a governor or a minister; those were the two.
Those were my options. When I was, I think I was 10 years old, she got me an appointment to the United States Senate to be a page.
Yes.
They used to have young boys there. Uh-huh. And I said, well, what do you do? She says, well, you get up at like 4 a.m. and then you go lay out papers and you live in a dormitory and all this. And I didn't want to do it. And I told my mother and she said, The first time I ever saw my mother stand up to my grandmother, she said, he's not going to go. So I turned it down. Yeah.
Would that have been with Strom Thurmond by any chance?
It was actually, Strom Thurmond was a senator then.
Yeah.
And, but the senior senator then was Olin Johnston, and that's who it was. Okay. Speaking of Strom Thurmond, I'm researching the possibility of doing a little play about Strom Thurmond.
Well, it's very relevant.
He's
at least being whispered about in the news quite a bit. The women on Capitol Hill said the rule was never get on the elevator with him.
Yeah.
Have you heard that?
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of sexual harassment.
Yeah, and you know he had a black daughter and supported her through the years. It's a very, very interesting topic.
It's so complicated.
Yeah, it is. You know, and it's interesting today that the latest play that I wrote, Rebel Yell, is a play about how a 15-year-old boy becomes a member of the Ku Klux Klan.
Right.
In 1920, in the South in 1920. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that based on family stories or
somewhat? Uh-huh. Somewhat. It's a lot of it is based on a dynamic between my father and a man he called his black brother. Uh-huh. They grew up together on the farm, and he actually saved the black man saved my father's life as a boy. Mm-hmm. And anyway, it's loosely based on some things. I think writers try to be authentic and always try to you know bring my own experience to most anything that I write.
Sure.
Yeah.
But this choice between the initial, at least, disappointment that you did not become a minister and then your retort to her that theater is a form of ministry.
It really is. It really is to me. It's very much a place where we commune together, we come together, and we share our life experiences back and forth. And that's one of the magical things about theater that I don't think really you sense in really any – you don't sense it in film, certainly. Mm-hmm. It's a totally different experience. I did want to tell you there's a follow-up to that story about the plastic roses, if we have a minute.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The latter part of that story is about when a burglar broke into their home and locked them – in the upstairs bathroom and at gunpoint. Ooh. And he said, I'm going to find the money and then I'm going to come back here and kill you. And he couldn't find anything and he got angrier and angrier and he burst into, but in the meantime, my grandfather was praying at the commode, you know, at the toilet. And, grandmother was furiously thinking about what to do. She said, God helps those that helps themselves. And she found a bottle of Clorox. And what she did when he broke back into the room, she had a glass full of Clorox, which she threw in his eyes.
No way.
Yes. And they got away. They got away.
These were your elderly grandparents?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
I mean, in my mind, I was there with Truman Capote and In Cold Blood, and I just saw the worst about to happen.
Yeah.
And God helps. So there's a theological difference between your grandmother and your grandfather that saved them.
Yeah, very much so. She was very proactive, as we would say.
Wow.
Speaking of that kind of religiosity thing, there's a very dark part of the story that is about a relative, and we've never openly discussed it, but all things pointed to his suicide. Mm-hmm. And grandmother went into deep mourning after he died. Yeah. And in the play, I asked her, I said, it must be a comfort seeing the world in black and white. And she said, yes, it is a comfort, but it's also sanity. Yeah.
In Southern culture, but in a lot of culture, death, as your first story indicated, suicide, as this indicates, mm-hmm. are just taboo topics.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
maybe part of the taboo is for sanity's sake.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
But it's, it's an interesting dichotomy of what I've learned through the years and about my relationship with her. And as I say in this, she really did teach me about faith and about courage and about passion. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably, as I said, she was the greatest actress I ever saw. So I naturally went into the theater and she called me show trash.
When you use that word show trash, at first, of course, I grimaced.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's who you, that's your identity, your core identity,
yes.
and you're being
yes.
trashed for it.
Yes.
But then you said she had a smile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was her, it's interesting, she could get away with so many things, but that smile would just disarm you. And, and that was from her generation. Uh-huh. They believed that people in the theater were all terrible people.
So. But, if she had been born in another time or place, could you see her doing what you're doing? Is she sort of
she would have been
a parallel universe of
I
you?
Would love that. I would love that. Yeah, it would have been wonderful to see that happen with her. But, she was of her time.
Yeah.
And, I think reflecting back on other generations is a very important process to come. Again, this whole comparison mm-hmm. of our life experiences is what is really meaningful, I think.
But the constraint in her that she would proudly show that magazine to her friends, but kind of keep it secret from you because she was, I guess, more concerned about your soul.
Yes.
There was a war within her between her pride for what you'd accomplished, but her worry about your soul, I
guess.
That's
right. That's right. Exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's true. It's that sort of odd polarity. That mm-hmm. that I found often in her. But there's a story also in the play about how she loved to tell stories when we would go on trips together to go to church mm-hmm. meetings. And we'd be in the dark, we'd get lost on back roads, and this mm-hmm. is before interstates or anything. And she told me a story about when she was a bride and went to a plantation to visit some people, and she and my grandfather, this is right after they're married, were in separate bedrooms, as, of course, she loved that. But a wild man came in her bed. Mm-hmm. He was wild. He had long hair. He was not shaven. He crouched over her, and she told me that what she did is she started saying the Lord's Prayer, under her breath. Mm-hmm. And as he did, he calmed down and he finally went away. Well, the next morning, it's really a true story, mm-hmm. but it's like Jane Eyre. It's mm-hmm. this man had been kept by his family up in the upper part of the house. And what he did is when he left her room, he went in to the creek near the house and drowned.
Oh.
And so Yeah, I mean, that Southern Gothic thing is just, and it's, you
I
know,
thought of Boo Radley.
Oh, right, exactly.
Yeah, I think exactly. Our family had a couple of uncles who were like that.
Yeah.
There was,
There's so many stories to tell. And that's one thing, you know, I did an interview for the magazine, the Dramatists Guild. And they asked me, what advice do you give playwrights? And I had three words: tell good stories.
Hmm.
Yeah. That's what it's all about. Yeah.
Well, we've got 30 seconds, but what is it you like about stories, and what is it you like about the theater? That's been implicit in everything you've said tonight, but I wonder if you had one statement you wanted to.
Well, again, it is. I think the one thing I ask of my life was try to experience, to have a truly human experience in my life, and to experience all the emotions and passions and whatever. And the theater is such a passionate business that, you know, it just seemed to fit for me. Yeah. And my human experience is always against what we're seeing on the stage.
Well, I think your grandmother is up there in heaven, of course. And she's saying, Ted, you told some really good stories.
Yeah.
And your stories do save souls. Your stories speak to my spirit.
Thank you so much.
In a deep and
profound
way. I
very much appreciate that. Thank you.
You've introduced our listeners to stories that link us to our past and give us direction for the future. Ted, your stories are full of intrigue and surprise and authentic Southern culture, as well as some wit and wisdom, some fascinating characters, of course, and reminders of the past that help shape who we are in the present. Stories about families being strange and yet so wonderful. Thank you for being on our show.
Thank you. Enjoyed it very much.
And don't you dare move, because Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are waiting in the wings to share their cool classics. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Warren Holloman, along with Ted Swindley and the entire So What's Your Story team, reminding you that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there.
By joining KPFT's Sustainer program this hour, you can support your local non-commercial station and help KPFT reduce its pledge drives. Rather than giving a yearly gift, Sustainers give a monthly donation that continues as long as you want. Giving 5, 20, 100, or more monthly helps change the way KPFT works. Sustainers help us meet our operating expenses without days and days of on-air fundraising. That means less pledge drive, more efficiency, and greater stability for KPFT, regardless of the time of year. Again, visit KPFT.org to make a difference today. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, KPFT.org worldwide.
You are listening to KPFT.
Hello! It's that Vinyl Show!